I'm delighted to welcome to the Radio Cafe Susan Fisher Sterling. She's director of the National Museum of Women in the Arts, and she will be speaking on Thursday, the 6th of August at 7 o'clock in the evening at Santa Fe Prep on the topic, How Women Artists Shape the Arts and Contribute to Social Change. It's part of a series sponsored by the Women's International Studies Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Mary Charlotte.
Let's talk for a moment about the museum itself. You're director of this wonderful place, the National Museum of Women in the Arts. How did the museum come into being?
The museum was actually the brainchild, the great idea of Wilhelmina Cole Holliday. And Wilhelmina and her husband Wallace were art collectors. She had been on the board of another museum in Washington, and they were doing some traveling and starting to collect art. And I think they realized, I believe, in the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Vienna, when they saw the work of Clara Peters, they were very interested in that work. And when they came back to Washington, they actually went looking for Peters' art. They went to the major textbook, Janssen's History of Art, and they realized that there was no Clara Peters in that textbook. And in fact, they made the astonishing discovery at the time in the 70s that there were actually no women at all in the major textbook used in every university and college in the United States. And so they created a focus for their collection, and ultimately that collection became the core donation that began the museum.
What is the historical and geographical range of work that's represented in the museum?
The National Museum of Women in the Arts has work from Europe and the United States, a small amount of work from Latin America and Asia. Most of the work is, though, from Europe starting in the 16th century, and then it runs all the way to the present day, and as obviously as American art develops, and especially with contemporary art, our collections are quite deep in American and European contemporary art.
Were you part of the process of putting together the collection in the museum?
When I was one of the curators at the museum and as chief curator and deputy director, I was in part responsible for putting together the collection for the museum, or at least setting its parameters. I'll be honest, it really is donors like the Holidays or donors like Tony Podesta or Stephen Scott and others who collect contemporary art who really help make the collection happen. Because like most museums, we make some acquisitions, but many, many, many of our works come through donation.
So let's talk for a moment about, there are distinctions that are made sometimes when you hear people talking about art or read about art, between art and craft, between high art and folk art. And these are often terms that are used to put women in, or put people into certain categories, including women. What is your perspective on this and this way of talking about art?
My perspective on the fine art craft or fine art and design delineation that is oftentimes made in museums is that at the Women's Museum, we should not be making those distinctions. And in fact, we don't. Part of the reason for that is because for centuries, millennia, in fact, probably, women have been making contributions to the artistic identity of this world through works that are not necessarily painting and sculpture. Those areas oftentimes were highly colonized by men, and women weren't able to break into that system. But when you think about the works that are done in clay, when you think about tapestries, other textile arts, when you think about design, especially handmade design, women really have always been contributors in that way. Our collection has some key areas, like we do collect pottery. Right now we don't have the facility to be able to collect textile arts, but we will. And our sense is, when it comes to our exhibitions, that we really do treat all art as having an important base in just a woman's drive to be creative. And in fact, our fall show, which is called Pathmakers, is all about women in design.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that because there's a lot of stuff going at the museum. It's very much of a kind of living space for art and for artists. But I want to stay with the historical for a while. I mean, I went to college back in the day and was an art history major, and we had that Janssen textbook. And I don't even know at the time, because I was sort of brainwashed and old school myself, that there weren't any women artists in it. And one of the things that's really confusing or hard to understand is that, I mean, there have been, not only today and in the last 20, 30, 40 years, many successful women artists known in their time, but then forgotten by history, while their male counterparts are the ones who make it into the books and the museums. How do you understand that? I mean, is that unconscious bias? Is that conscious bias?
When it comes to the idea of unconscious bias and the history of art, I think it's a very hard, or it's a hard nut to crack. I know that there are lots of factors. When Linda Nochlin, the great feminist art historian, wrote her generative work in 1971 called Why Are There No Great Women Artists, she set out a number of criteria. In large part, women weren't given the same opportunities as men to participate in the art world. The way, the conditions under which women operated, the way they were trained, the way they were kept at home, the sorts of things they were allowed to do in society, really very much kept them out of the mainstream of art. If a woman like Lavinia Fontana, the first professional woman artist in the Renaissance, who came from Bologna, she, if you take her as an example, she became an artist because her father was an artist, and she married an artist, and that man actually helped her build her career. She was written about by Malvasia, a great biographer of artists, but when it came to writing art history in the 19th century, there was this sort of subterranean ditching, if you will, of women artists. And I don't think it was even conscious. You even have examples of an artist like Judith Leister, who was part of the Harlem School of Dutch painting. And her work looked a lot like Frans Hals, who was the known head of the Harlem School. And some unscrupulous dealer in the 19th century replaced Leister's signature with Hals. So there were obviously these sorts of distinctions being made about the, not the quality of the women's work, but the saleability of their work or their a sense of where they stood in history. A very small number of artists were women in the history of art, but now we know many, many of their names, and they're very much a part of art history today.
That is such an interesting and kind of scandalous story that some art dealer kind of rubbed out this woman's name who was a great painter and put in Frans Hals' name. And what happened? It was found later when the painting, when some of those paintings were cleaned?
It was found when the paintings were cleaned. We also know that she stopped painting at a very young age. And this is another thing that happened to women. So oftentimes, if they were to marry, and if they married an artist, they would stop doing their own work. So the way in which society was constructed, really up until the late 19th century, did not allow women the opportunity that we now see today in art.
The title of that article from 1971 by Linda Nochlin, Why Are There No Great Women Artists, was meant to be, I'm sure, very provocative, and because, I mean, it outlined the various problems and issues that women face in trying to become artists, but there have been lots of great women artists.
There have been lots of great women artists. In fact, one has to really look at them as the great exceptions. And we talk a lot about artists, whether they're Vigée Le Brun, the court painter to both Marie Antoinette and Catherine the Great. We all, us or others such as Rosa Bonheur in the mid 19th century. We talk about these women as exceptional because when you think about the fact that they really had great difficulty receiving an arts education, that they oftentimes were never really allowed to study from the nude and had to gain all their understanding through visualization as opposed to really studying anatomy. When you think about the system that really always favored the men, where Vigée Le Brun and two of her contemporaries were the first women ever who were brought into the Royal Academy in Paris, there were lots of ways in which these women surmounted odds to get to where they ultimately got to and to achieve the fame that they did. Remembering artists or being an artist who is remembered in history is difficult enough, but having obstacles that you constantly have to jump over, as Germaine Greer called it, the obstacle race, it was absolutely true for women artists. But any number of them have prevailed. And the good thing is, almost 35 years later, Janssen's History of Art now has about 300 women artists. But that's out of more than 4,000. So the odds are still about 10%.
And, of course, there's that great woman artist known as Anonymous.
Yes, the late, great Miriam Shapiro did an incredible series that we have here at the museum called Anonymous Was a Woman. And there are many people who speculate even that works like the Bayeux Tapestry that chronicles William the Conqueror's conquest of Britain, where actually that was actually done in an abbey by women. I'm not absolutely sure that that's true, but it's an interesting theory.
I mean, one thinks about things that are not really art-related, but there's a kind of cliche about what goes on in a lot of companies, which is a woman will suggest an idea at a meeting, and then the next day a man will suggest the same idea, and everybody jumps on it, and he gets credit for it. And you wonder how many millennia that kind of thing has been going on, both in and outside of the arts.
I think that the arts do tend to mirror this social landscape, and if we think about a social landscape in which women are across the board discounted, it's no wonder that it happens also in the arts. One of the classic examples really is Lee Krasner, who was Jackson Pollock's wife. And Hans Hofmann, her teacher, Hans Hofmann was the great teacher of the abstract expressionists. And Hofmann once said about Krasner, "This work is so good you would not know it was by a woman."
Right, right.
And also, Krasner and Pollock worked side by side on creating all over paintings. Krasner's now recognized. She was recognized beginning in the 1980s when she was already in her 70s. She was being recognized as a really fine artist. Her husband was recognized when he was in his 30s. So women, even in the last 60, 70 years, women have had to wait much, much longer to gain their due. And Krasner's an interesting example. The other thing that I find amazing about her is her name was Lenore, and she shortened it to Lee in order to be more gender neutral, in hopes that her works would sell because people wouldn't know whether she was a woman or not. So that kind of prejudice, that kind of discrimination runs really deep. It's a psychological barrier to being able to see yourself even as the great artist.
We're talking to Susan Fisher Sterling, director of the National Museum of Women in the Arts. And the topic of your talk next week is how women artists shape the arts and contribute to social change. And one of the things that's so exciting to me about the museum, which, by the way, is in Washington, D.C., I don't know if I mentioned that, is that you have so much going on there. It seems like very much of a kind of living space where people are working and talking and sharing ideas and all kinds of public programs. Talk about what's going on there. There's one particular artist really stood out to me, Natalie Jeremijenko.
This fall, we actually are initiating a new public programs department, and the key driver for that department will be women, arts, and social change. And Jeremijenko, is one of my favorites, and she'll be speaking at the museum in November. And what she does is she's a technologist as well as an artist, and she creates various sorts of objects like robot dogs that are cute little items that also smell out toxins in the environment and bark at the number of toxins. And she also creates these beautiful floating mats that she puts in the East River of New York that have these beacons that go off every time a fish goes underneath the floating mat, and the fish will actually text you if you're an observer and tell you what the water quality is like. And then Jeremijenko gives you these pellets that you can throw to the fish to feed them that are chelating agents, and they take the toxins and they neutralize them in the fish, the toxins that come from the PCBs that General Electric put into the waters of the East River years ago from its major plant in New York City. Jeremijenko thinks of her work as being that of an artistic technologist, and she runs what is called NYU's Environmental Health Clinic, not your normal student health clinic, but she does empower others. She empowers her community, if you will, to recognize that the chain of events that happen to upset the balance of oxygen in the water is actually part of what upsets the balance in their day ecologically in New York.
It's such interesting work and beautiful work at the same time, and there seems to be a lot of socially focused work by women. I imagine that they're not getting rich because you can't sell that kind of work in galleries, but do you think women are more geared toward that kind of socially focused work?
The art of social practice, which is this socially focused work, that's at least the name that's used most often, is really an open space. There are lots of women practitioners and also men. There are colleges of art that teach this as a discipline now. In fact, Santa Fe Art Institute and also the California College of Art have programs in this area. And the art of social practice is becoming more and more important over the last set of years as, frankly, as we as a society worry more about what the future will hold. Artists are always standard bearers or ciphers, if you will, for those things that we're very much concerned about in our world. And women do tend to do great work in social practice, but don't always get the same recognition. So they may be early adopters of this new regime, this new way of working with communities and with social problems, economic problems, environmental problems, but getting them the credit that they're due and the exposure is something that this museum, the Women's Museum, is doing.
There's quite a lot of international work, too. Tell us about, for example, the work in Rwanda and in Haiti that you're featuring at the museum.
Women, Arts, and Social Change is a series of, as I said, is a series of public programs. And one of the things we realize is that we can curate exhibitions in the galleries, and it takes about 2 to 3 years, and then the art goes up in the gallery and people come to see it. But there's also these days a much faster way to curate, if you will. I know that's a term that a lot of millennials use, but in doing public programs that involve artists, we can show you more art than we're able to through just our exhibition program. And so one of the things we're interested in is change by design, because our environment is totally designed. We may not recognize that day in and day out, but when you walk into a building, when you sit in a chair, when you actually engage with others in a space, that's the designed environment. And there are artists, there are architects like Liz Ogbu, who are working on things like, how do you create a day laborer's space? that is on that street corner where you see those laborers every day, a space that will allow them to have some dignity, that might have a place where they can sit down, that would have wash basins and a bathroom, that might have an office where they would be able to look for various kinds of work. That notion of a user-centric building is something that we're going to be looking at in a program called Building for Better. And there are artists like Swoon, who is a wheat paste artist from Brooklyn. She's a graffiti artist. And what she has done, though, is she's taken her interest in using the things that people throw away to be able to create different sorts of spaces and objects. But lately, when she looked at what had gone on in Haiti after the earthquake, she knew that there was a way that she could work with a community in Barrière-Jeudi, Haiti, where the worst of the earthquake happened, a non-NGO-like format. She was able to help them build a new community center using a kind of beehive structure that would be earthquake-proof. And now that community center, as she calls it, has laptops in it that are solar-powered, and this small town, this small city, is now connected to the world in a way it had not been for some years. So artists are thinking, whether they're architects or artists, they're thinking much more creatively. The Women's Center in Rwanda is actually an occupational center where women come from all over to sell their wares. And the company that created that was amazing because they worked on the space, which is very beautiful, made from local bricks with steel overhangs. The work that they did all via computer. They did not go to the site. The folks they worked with told them what kind of space they needed. They figured out how to use local materials and some small other materials that were brought in. But they really were able to work in a user-centric way where the people who needed the spaces were helping to create the spaces with the architects. And that's a revolution. That's no longer Ayn Rand and the Fountainhead and Frank Lloyd Wright telling you what your building should look like and what height ceilings you should have.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's a really natural synergy between the kind of work that you're describing and then that kind of large effort that's happening globally to educate women and girls, which seems to be, I mean, when women and girls are educated, society functions better, and this whole art seems to be part of that movement.
The art of social change is part of that larger movement that engages women and girls. In fact, when you think about how women are providing themselves as not only examples, but as mentors for girls around the world. There is an amazing film that was created about educating girls. And it was something I talked about when I was at the World Economic Forum in Tianjin. And it's called Girl Rising. And it really was a wonderful kind of social change documentary that discussed how girls, if given certain kinds of opportunities, are able to transcend the difficulties of their initial upbringing. Everything from a girl in Peru whose family is a mining family who now is a poet, to girls in Haiti who petitioned to go to school even though their family can't pay because they know that education is the way up.
Where are women at now? I mean, we're talking about the arts of social change, which I find really fascinating. And then there's the, you know, quote-unquote, the system, which is made up of institutions, galleries, museums, both in the U.S. and in other countries. There has been a kind of movement over the last, what, sort of 30, 40 years to start collecting statistics. And you mentioned earlier that the art history textbook that was read by everybody had a conspicuous absence of women. What about galleries and museums? How are women doing? What kind of changes have we seen?
when we think about the art world, there are a lot of reasons to keep statistics, because there's social change in that as well. We think oftentimes about how well women are doing as artists. People know who know something about art might know the names of the photographer Cindy Sherman, or they might know the wonderful sculptor Louise Bourgeois, or they may know a painter like Julie Moretu, who is having major successes in the world. But when it comes down to it, it's very hard to realize that these may, again, be exemplary women who are brought out, always trotted out as the examples. And it's always good to try and get into the data, to get into the details, to see if women are really doing better. And there is a movement afoot now, again, every 10, 15 years this happens, where women get together, and some empathetic men, to really take a look at what are the stats, how well are women doing. And unfortunately, the answer is not as well as you think. Most museums, especially major art museums across the country, if they show women 20% of the time, it's a lot. When it comes to the gallery system, there's a group that Michal Hebron runs called Gallery Tally, and they do a wonderful poster that says the glass is 32.2% full, which represents how many galleries had women at the most recent Art Basel in Miami. These kinds of stats are very important markers or measures. And one of the things we realize in the art market is last year, for example, in the London sales in the winter, there was not a single woman artist in the top 100 lots for sale in the marketplace in at the auctions. That is really telling, because what it says is that we have this stratification where the great male artist, normally white, normally heterosexual, is still the end-all and be-all in the art market and, to some degree, still in the art world. So how do we get more women, more persons of color, more queer, genderqueer, and LGBT into a marketplace or actually an art space that seems very closed even today?
Yeah, it's not like these folks aren't going to art school.
No, and in fact, in art school, women make up the majority of artists in art school. The question is, what is it about the system that could be seen as slightly insidious or is off, that puts women off their game? George O'Keeffe used to say, you know, men used to try to tell her how to paint, tell her what to paint, tell her when to paint. And, you know, they also told her she couldn't be a great artist, so she just stopped listening.
Yeah, yeah.
But the point is you have to have someone like Alfred Stieglitz, who was her husband, in order to make sure that an artist like O'Keeffe could become famous. I don't know that she would have been able to make it in a vacuum.
There are more women in not only artists, but in every other position in society, including curators and museum directors like you and gallery owners and art critics and so on. Does that help? Do women support each other and bring each other forward?
I think there are many examples where women are influencing the choices of women artists for exhibitions, for gallery representation, and the like. But I also believe there has to be a concerted effort across the field. We know the bias exists. I think that as you add women to the field, there are some women who are very supportive, and there are some women who frankly still believe that they just know the best art, and it doesn't matter whether it's a man or a woman who's created it, whether it's someone heterosexual or someone queer. So the biggest problem is to understand that the system has its biases, and that women in positions of authority can make a difference. In a sense, there is that lean-in opportunity in the art world just as there is in the business world. And the idea is to take it and move it forward. As a woman who has been a curator and now is a director, I feel that's my responsibility.
Susan Fisher Sterling is director of the National Museum of Women in the Arts. She will be speaking on Thursday, August 6th, here in Santa Fe at 7 in the evening at Santa Fe Prep on the topic, How Women Artists Shape the Arts and Contribute to Social Change. It's part of a series sponsored by the Women's International Study Center, and there's more information on their website. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me. A real pleasure.